So we have said that the fact that the Bible goes so quickly to an issue between human beings, the human race so far, and their creator is instructive. And we found that the issue is a great problem, a huge problem, an incredible problem. And there's this other voice and another deception out there. We're going to ask where the story goes from here. And I do this all the time through these lectures. I always tell you how many pages, right? In the next 6.5 pages, this edition, in the next 6.5 pages, we're going to cover about 1,800 years. Isn't that instructive? I mean, I think, what is message? What is theme? How are we getting the story? That's instructive to say that we would get that much year, that many years. So whatever points are being made must be pretty simple. There are not many points that are made in these years. Here's the sad part about those 6.5 pages. We got one dominant theme: distrust of God, disobedience to God, disloyalty to God, harm for other people, and consequences. 6.5 pages, 1,800 years, and that's dominant theme. We remember that at the creation of the whole thing, everything was described as good at creation. It was a great scenario, a great job description for human beings. And there was, in fact, only one statement of prohibition, which we haven't actually touched on yet, right? There was one statement of prohibition. Maybe you are familiar with that statement of prohibition. The Lord commanded the man, saying, "You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." You know, once again, we might say, "What about that? I want more explanation." We might speculate, you know, what's going on? Why did God do it that way? And of all the things we might speculate about, what is the human condition of not knowing good and evil? What is that? How does taking a piece of fruit make a difference? You know, there's a lot of things we might speculate about. There's a lot of things that are not revealed about why God chose to do it exactly that way. But let's at least not make it an insignificant thing. Kind of an inane warning, something like, "Don't you dare put your hand in that cookie jar." You know, we cannot reduce it to that, because the issues that we've seen are cosmic in their proportion, right? We have the Creator God, Master Architect of all that is beautiful and good, and everything created good, and mankind created in his image. And we have human beings that are going to be dealing with whether they will believe him or not, and whether they will take charge of their own situation and say, "I don't think the message I received from him is the complete story here," and they're believing another speaker. And the stakes are high, right? Life and death, do not eat this, or you will die. The issues are cosmic in their proportion. Let us not reduce that to something small as though it were only, "Don't put your hand in the cookie jar." Whom will they believe, these first human beings? Whom will they serve? Whom will they obey? And will they listen to the other voice? Will they spurn God's command, presuming that they know better, or that they should have been allowed what he disallowed? Those are the issues, and they are cosmic in their proportion. The stakes are high. What are the stakes on that quote, "life and death"? And we can't soften that if we're actually taking the message as it is given. We cannot soften that. We might be tempted to want to minimize the issue, saying, wow, how harsh is that? That seems too harsh. Death itself, mortality, coming into the world because they took the piece of fruit, we might want to minimize that, but we can't. Not if we're going to receive the message from the giver of the message. And I think we get some sense that the issues really are that big. How do you deal with your Creator, the one who gave you life to begin with? Let's go on to the actual words of the temptation exchange, and we'll see what's going on. Of course, the first two human beings are Adam and Eve, and Satan approached Eve with a question. Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? Again, I've begun to describe what seems to be the whole method here. Calling into question what God had said. Casting doubt in their minds. Does he have your best interests in mind? Has he withheld some information from you? Is he withholding something good from you that you could have? Do you see what's going on? Did God say, do you see how it's actually twisted? Did God say you shall not eat of any tree? Of course he didn't say that. He said you can eat of every tree. We just read that. Except one. You may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. No, actually, Eve says, no, that's not what he said. Right? You may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that's in the midst of the garden, and neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Take note of Satan's words. Let's compare. You shall die. There is direct contradiction here. God, it's calling into question the truthfulness of God in direct contradiction. You shall not surely die. And again, portraying God through the whole scenario, portraying God as the God who deprives, the God who forbids, the God who isn't letting you in the whole story, who doesn't have your best interests in mind, and again with direct contradiction. Well, the woman saw that the tree was good for food. We're actually not sure it was an apple. She saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes, and the tree was desired to make one wise. And she took of its fruit and ate, and she gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Let me ask you this. Now, having a knowledge of evil by experience, they have now participated in evil, what evil is. Evil was in the world, in the universe already, right? We don't have a whole lot of backstory on that, but it was already there. But now they're participating. How did that affect the relationship between created mankind and their God? I thought I would borrow a sculpture from Rodin, because I think he did a good job. Shame came into the picture, and dread and fear of God. The man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord called to the man, "Where are you?" And what did Adam say? "I hid," right? I haven't got all the text in front of you. "I hid among the trees of the garden because I was afraid." And into the world, at that time, into the world came pain and toil and hardship and conflict and death. Yes, death itself. Were the issues between Creator and created persons matters serious enough that the unbelief and the rebellion against him and the listening to and the following of the suggestions of his enemy were to bring about the consequence of mortality? Yes, they were. Death entered the world. New Testament says that. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me stay with the Old Testament. You know, the Lord simply told Adam, dust you are, and to dust you will return. This is the consequence of these things. But it does talk about it in the New Testament. Sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin. This is a continuous story. That's 4,000 years apart. But it's a continuous story. Sin entered the world and death. That's why we die. And we all die. So, is that the end of it? Story over? Bad project? We're done? The answer is no. It's not over. It's not over with the human race. Not over with Adam and Eve. And even in the midst of God conveying words to them that were about the curses that had come into their lives because of their sin, even as he talks about death, even as he talks about pain and hardship and toil and conflict, even as he talks about all of them, he talks to Eve about children. There will be children. It's not over. There will be children in the world. And you will bear children, and not all of them will follow Satan. As a matter of fact, some of your children, Eve, will be enemies of Satan. I mean, isn't that what he's telling her? I'm sorry. I'm presuming a familiarity with that aspect of the words, and I shouldn't do that. He is saying that some of them will, in fact, have enmity. They will be enemies of Satan. And not only... Now, I could say it this way. There will always be some of Eve's children that will follow God and not Satan. But there is more. Even at first, even in the midst of talk of the curse, there is more. Are you ready for this? Want to talk about prediction and fulfillment? There is reference to one with Eve. Someone coming. I think it begins general, you know, not every child will, but it is also specific. And he shall, well, this is the curse upon Satan. He's going to bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. What imagery is that taken of, right? From a human being stepping on a snake, right? Stepping on a snake's head. You might get it in the heel, but the snake goes down. And here is hope. Here is hope for the human race. Born to some descendant of Eve is a person, someone who will be instrumental in the defeat and destruction of Satan himself. There's not a whole lot of explanation right here, but it's everything. We'll find out in time. And it's singular. This is not nothing. This is prophecy. This is prediction. He will come. And he will crush Satan's head. And Satan will strike out at him too. There's so much more that we could talk about with Adam and Eve. Let me just touch on this. The sin of Adam and Eve alienated them from God. And there's an issue of God being with and being present with them. They were thrust out of the garden. God's presence is a big deal in the theme. And they are alienated from him. And that happens early on like this. What's the next part of the story? We're still on that same old theme. The next part after Adam and Eve will be... what's it going to be? Murder. If you don't already know the Cain and Abel story, that's one thing. Cain and Abel. Murder in the first family. Brother against brother is going to be part of this story. In short, the scripture teaches that both of the brothers, and they're not little children like some of the Sunday school materials. They're not little children probably at this time. They're keeping flocks and whatever. And both brothers had brought an offering to the Lord. This is all new, by the way, right? Have we had any explanation about offerings to the Lord? Nothing. It's all new. They both brought an offering to the Lord, and the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. And so Cain was very angry and his face fell. We don't know exactly what was wrong with Cain's offering, right? But we have some text. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? So there's something wrong with what's going on, even in, I think, the offering. If you do well, so they're getting more than we are. And you know what I'm saying? The Lord's revealed more. How do they even know to bring offerings? But we don't get a lot of explanation. That's fine. That's actually fine. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at your door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. In the end, in his hatred, Cain lured Abel into the field and killed him. And on one level, what is it? It's part of that theme. The human race is not doing well. And it's just part of the theme. But this story, interestingly, brings in a couple of other things. Again, going back, well, maybe I go ahead. Yeah, that's what I wanted to show. We have been introduced, we, the readers, have been introduced to offerings. Something had been revealed to these people that they would bring offerings because it says that the Lord received Abel and his offering. So what Abel was doing was acceptable. And I don't want to go past that too quickly. Animal sacrifice acceptable to God. I need an explanation for that one. Right? If I don't get an explanation, all that is seems to be barbaric. Don't primitive people do that kind of thing? You know, God needs an offering, so I gotta kill an animal for him. I need an explanation, which the scripture will provide. But I don't want to go past it too quickly. It ought to make your stomach turn some. I think it's actually instructive to let your stomach turn a bit. That in an act of worship, they had to bring an animal and bloodshed and all of that kind of thing. I want the explanation. We're going to get it. Actually, we're going to get some before the end of this lecture. So that's good. Well, let me talk about this. We talked about genealogies, right? The story follows one genealogy and not another. The first little genealogy is of Cain, but we don't follow it very far. Just a few names, general, you know, categories. This son kind of had, you know, the people that come from his son kind of did this. The people come from his son did this. And then the story is over with Cain. I don't mean there were no more descendants, but I mean to say that the storyline is going to track elsewhere to have God reveal to us what we need to know. It's not going to follow Cain anymore and his line. In Cain's line, in that little scenario of genealogy, we get a little information, you know, this son did that, the descendants of these people did that. There's only one more cameo. It's a guy named Lamech. So if we only get one cameo, what's the general message about this family line? It's not so good, right? He is proud of being a murderer like his ancestor and proud of giving more consequence than the injury he received. He hurt me, I killed him. And he's boasting to that effect. I think that's instructive. This is a very short story. We haven't heard a lot for a whole lot of generations. We get one cameo. What's the message? The human race is not doing well. Cain's line is not doing well. So the picture for the world's kind of bleak right now. Until the Lord grants the birth of another heir and son. And Seth is born. To Eve is given another child. And she praises God. She says, God has appointed for me another offspring. And there's a little measure of hope in chapter 4 in that bleak world. What's that measure of hope at the bottom of chapter 4? Or I mean at the latter portion of that text. And then, I mean, you know, Seth has a son, the son has a son. And then people began to call upon the name of the Lord. You know, if Seth doesn't come along, all of God's promises to Eve fail. Right? Somebody's got to follow the Lord. Otherwise, his promises failed. There's going to be one born who will defeat Satan without Seth. And it's going to be Seth's line that we follow. We follow the storyline through Seth at that point. The next section, the next story, after Cain and Abel, races through a few centuries. And it's mostly a genealogy. It's about all you get, a genealogy. And how do those genealogies go? So-and-so lived so many years and had an heir. It's the descendants of Seth. Somebody lived so many years, had an heir, had other sons and daughters, lived this many years, and died. You know, end of every paragraph. And he died, and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. They live longer than we do. But every paragraph ends in, and he died, and he died, and he died. Except one paragraph. Enoch walked with God, and he was no more. Or, you know, he was not, for God took him. That's so out of sequence, right? Not a lot of explanation. But it's a little glimmer, you know? And the New Testament makes reflection on that and said, yep, sure enough, Enoch didn't die. God just took him home. You know, so it's like the first biblical indicator that there's going to be a hope that goes beyond the grave, a hope of heaven itself, a hope of being with God. God can take you and be your own. We'll get to there. But again, there's not much explanation here. So keep in mind, this is my high horse. Keep in mind that we have, in very few words, had described to us a very long time. The point must be fairly simple in the first pages of the Bible.
Genesis 5:4, Adam had other sons and
after
daughters,
wonderful,
a wife
beautiful,
for Cain
bountiful,
must have come
good creation
man.
Of God. We hear about the first disloyalty. We hear about the first murder within a family, brother against brother. We follow one family line a little bit, but we realize that it is boastful murderers in that family line. Centuries pass. The consequence is real. Mortality is in the world. People die and people die. Centuries pass. If the story is clipping along like that for 1800 years, what's the basic message? Well, let's think about summary verses. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. That's one of the key verses that I'm talking about. You want to talk about verses that tell you what the story is about? If you get 1800 years in that short of a deal, that's the explanation. That's the theme. That's the dominant theme. And it's at this point that we actually come to something very hard in the Bible. Judgment. Now understand, we have already seen judgment, right? Sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, and we all face that. So the consequence of sin being death happens to the whole human race, always happens to the whole human race. But here, God chose to have it happen all at once. All at once. Same. It's not different from the judgment for sin, but he had it happen all at once. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I've created from the face of the land. I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life under heaven. But here's an element of storyline, but, and he's saying this to that person we know as Noah, but I will establish my covenant with you. Covenant. There's an idea. What is a covenant, by the way? How do you make one? Make a covenant, right? A covenant is a promise. It is a, I'm going to, or whatever. It's a promise on oath. That's what makes a covenant a covenant. It's got to be a promise on oath. And we will find that the word covenant is really significantly, thematically important. As he approaches mankind in that wretched state of wickedness and grabs somebody and says, I'm going to make a covenant with you. God is making commitments. He is initiating commitment to this person, Noah. I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark. You and your son, or your wife and your sons and their wives, to keep you alive. And of course, he was called upon to bring animal type representatives, so that the world could be full of its animals again, because animals walking along the face of the earth would have died in the flood as well. God's purposes for his creation were not finished, but is he not teaching us the consequence of rebellion against him is death? I would like to lighten that, and I cannot. I would like to lighten that. It's just my gut reaction. If I want to listen to the message, I cannot. The wages of sin has always been death. That's a New Testament phrase, wages of sin. The just compensation, shall we say, for sin is death. But here he teaches by bringing judgment all at once. But he had made a covenant commitment to Noah, and he preserved him, and he preserved his family. And he said, he made him a promise, another promise, right? I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. There's a point of reasoning in there. As far as bringing another flood and having the judgment come that way, he's not going to do that. Why? There's the answer. Because the intention of man's heart's evil from his youth. I'd have to be judging every month, every day, right? There's a reason there. And so God makes covenant commitment not to do it, extending mercy by initiation. He chooses not. And that's, I think, one of the key verses that tells us what's going on. He is going to give the world an opportunity to know him and still know him through Noah and through his family. I establish my covenant with you and all flesh. He's making a covenant with everybody, right? Never again will be cut off by the water of a flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. I set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be for a sign, a covenant between me and the earth. It shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow will be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant. What's the purpose of the rainbow in the cloud? It's not to give God a reminder. Right? Oh, that's right. I should not bring another flood. You know, it's not a reminder. It is a sign so that we may entrust ourselves to him. He has promised. Well, where does the story go after Noah? Where does the story go after Noah? You don't get much, you know? A few generations are going to go by. What do you get? A few stories. An issue of sin in Noah's own family, drunkenness on Noah's part, a sin of his son against him. Just a little information. We get a very brief outline, what is it, chapter 9 or so, where all the descendants of Noah, you know, Shem and Ham and Japheth and their descendants, so where did they go in the world when they went in the world? And you get that. And then you get an instance, one more record of an instance that's trouble. The people didn't spread out at first, and when they were together, they began to build. I'm thinking it probably was something like that. Because there are those in that area, you know, at about that time or so. And it may have had to do with worshiping the stars. It seems to have, from the scriptures text itself, seems to have to do with people trying to establish a name for themselves and have great accomplishments. Whatever the case, the Lord was not pleased with them. And he drove them out to inhabit the rest of the earth, confusing their languages so that they couldn't stay in one place. And they did. They had to go. And they went out and they inhabited all the places that are listed in Genesis chapter 9. There's another genealogy note before we move on. The record has not been of every family line, and even in Noah's family, the record of genealogy is not in every family line. We follow one of those three sons. There are Shem and Ham and Japheth. By the thing, I think I'm descended from Japheth, you know, but he didn't follow that line. Followed the line of Shem. There's a word connection that you already have in your head with this name. Do you know the word anti-Semitic? Right? That would be to be against the Semitic people, the Hebrew people, to be against them. Well, to be anti-Semitic is to be anti-Shemitic, because it's connected. They are the descendants of Shem. And that's why the word came into usage. Again, we've got genealogy. We are following a line, and it's connected from the beginning. And the next major story, major character after Noah's family, the next major character is going to be Abram. Avram. If you want to put a little more Hebrew pronunciation in there, or is that Yiddish? Avram. What is it? It is 8:15, and we are at the story of Avram. And you may be saying, how is the man going to finish the story of the whole Bible by tomorrow afternoon if all he has done is cover the first few pages in two lectures? But don't forget, we've covered 1,800 years. Okay? And these foundation pieces have to be laid. It's how God gave us the story so that we may know what the issues are. Here's an interesting thing. As stories unfold, right? Covering 1,800 years, 6.5 pages. Suddenly we get to Avram, and you get pages and pages and pages and pages of his story. I'm thinking, that's got to be important. This person, whatever God does with him has got to be important in the scenario. And sure enough, it is. Let me say four things about the character of Avram, or Abraham. The four things are these. Abraham came out of a context of unbelief in his family line, not a context of faith or piety or heroism. What's the condition of the world by the time you get to Abraham, right? And he, in his family, does not come from a heritage of faith or piety or heroism. Number two, the promises made to Abraham run deeper than a few material advantages and good prospects. Right? They're good promises to Abraham. But it's not just surface promises. They run deep. They run long. They are the promises upon which we depend. Thirdly, what goes on with him begins to unfold God's plan to redeem back to himself people from this wayward earth. There's a lot of population. There are a lot of human beings in the earth by the time of Abraham. And then finally, the last thing I want to look at with Abraham is a test of his faith, because it begins to unlock for us what animal sacrifice means, what it was all about from Abel and company on. And if Abraham is doing it, it's been around for 1,800 years. You know what I'm saying? So we got to find out, and his story is going to help us. In a storyline that has so emphasized human failure this much, it's instructive that God reaches out to this man. I'm not just guessing that Abraham and his family worshipped idols. I'm not just guessing. The report comes from Joshua, who is a later character. But when Joshua reflects backward and tries to give a lesson to the children of Israel, you know, in time, he says, long ago, your forefathers lived beyond the river, and that'd be Terah, the father of Abraham and of Nahor, and they served other gods. When you get to Abraham, there's a lot of culture happening in the world by that time. We've been through a lot of years. All over the planet, peoples are thinking, there must be gods. By this time, they're so long removed from the truth. There must be gods, and there must be a god in charge of crops, and there must be a god in charge of storms, and there must be a god in charge of war, and a god in charge of disease and death, and you name it. But the personal, the one true God, creator of heaven and earth, came to a man and spoke to him. When we list God's promises to Abraham, probably the first one that comes to mind is promised land, right? What did God promise Abraham? Promised land. So there's where Abraham lives, and I've tried to highlight the promised land. It's not really rectangular, but there you go. So we've got the promised land. And when you think of the list of promises that comes to Abraham, right? A promised land, an honored name, that a son would be born to him, that's going to be Isaac. That from that family line and that particular son, there would be a whole nation raised up. That's good. And that he would bless Abraham and bless him and curse his enemies. Anybody who curses you, I'll curse. Those are good things. But so far, if we just take them on one level, we could think that that's just material advantages, right? Land holding, that's good. Stature in the world, that's good. A lot of descendants in a nation, that's good. Protection, that's good. But the promises to Abraham run deeper. And I want to show you. If I want to point you to the singular text that is the core and heart of God's promise to Abraham, it is that one. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to what? To be God to you and to your offspring. That's what people need. They need God. They need him to be their God. They need him to be with them. They need to treat him as God, worship him. That's what it was all about. And his covenant with Abraham at its core is that, not just farmland. The covenant with God, or with Abraham, is that. He also said, in you, all the families of earth shall be blessed. You see how I'm saying it's bigger stuff than just, a good farm and nice flocks and herds and a good tent. All the nations of earth. So what do we got? We are beginning to see in the character Abraham a plan to bless persons from out of every tribe and every nation on the planet with the core issue that God would be their God. But it starts with Abraham. I will be your God and you will be my people. And I'll be faithful. And you see how God is the initiator there toward him. Abraham didn't deserve any of this. What do we have on record for Abraham's good deeds prior to this? But God is reaching to him, reaching out to him with, and that's why we get more pages. We get more pages because it's beginning to be unfolded to you and to me that God is doing something to reclaim persons. I need to get all the way, and we will have an opportunity to finish with this right now. I need to get all the way to the test in Abraham's life. There was a test. It's Genesis 22. God tested Abraham. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, offer him as a burnt offering. I want your stomach to turn. It should. And if you've read the story, if you know the story, if you're familiar with the story, you know that God was not really seeking human sacrifice to satisfy himself like that. But I want us to take this very seriously. From the beginning, all the sacrifices that related to, we'll learn more of this later, but the whole sacrifice Abel gave, that was burnt offering. That was burnt offering. It's been burnt offering from the beginning. Noah offered burnt offering. Abraham is called upon to go to a certain hill. I love that hill. Did you know it's a particular hill? Go to the region of Moriah to a hill that I will show you. We're going to find out where that hill is in time. That's a really important hill. Can't tell you yet. Got to come back tomorrow. But when you go to the hill, what did he have to do? What did Abraham have to do? To stand in front of a place that looks like judgment. Right? Doesn't that look like judgment? To stand in front of a place that looks like judgment, and what's on the line? His hope, his heritage, his whole deal is on the line. I think all of God's people all through the ages with regard to sacrifice were being called upon of God to stand before a place that looks like judgment. And that's what we have here. With Abraham, though, it's his son on the line, right? Before you're standing in front of the place of judgment, what do you do? Well, there's an offering that can be given there. But I think God called upon Abraham to face this. It's been the issue from the beginning. The wages of sin is death. The wages of sin is death. We've had the story. It's a dark story up to here. Right? And Abraham was called upon to stand in front of the place that looks like judgment, where blood gets shed and something gets burned. Even Isaac knew about that. Actually, Isaac didn't get the whole story till the end. Right, but as he's walking along with his father, and I don't think Isaac's 8 years old. I think he's older than that, but he's not old. Am I 16, 18? I don't know. Actually, the scripture doesn't say. But as they go along to this hill that God showed them, Isaac says, "Where's the lamb? I see the wood. I see the fire that we brought," because they would bring fire, you know, so they could light the fire. "I see the wood. I see the fire. Where is the lamb?" And the Lord asked Abraham to be confronted with that reality. The wages of your sin is death. I think it's exactly that. Be confronted with that until at the last moment, when he has the knife in his hand and when the knife is raised for... He didn't know what else to do. He just obeyed. What are you going to do? He heard the angel of the Lord say, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son." Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." Now we are beginning to understand animal sacrifice. The Lord will provide. Yahweh Yireh. I probably didn't pronounce that very well. But the Lord will provide. That's a different take on sacrifice than the whole barbaric idea. This is not about a greedy, demanding, oppressive God saying to his people, "Let's see if you can please me. You know, bring your best. Let's see. You really, let me see if you can please me. Bring your children." It's not that. He was teaching them. Making them face it. I'm not saying the issues are small. He made them face a scenario of death judgment and fire. But the whole point, and the whole point from Abel on, is that he provides. So what's the lesson when you're standing there with your sacrifice? The Lord provided a way that I didn't have to die for my sin and be judged in the fire. And I think that is a lesson. That is the lesson. It's been the lesson since Abel. The message of this, I want you to receive it as message. Not just an isolated story, you know what I'm saying? See it in terms of why it's in there. Why did we hear about Cain and Abel? Why did we hear about the flood? Why did we race through generations and generations with hardly a word? Why were there summary words about the condition of mankind? Why was there a flood? Why was Abraham chosen of all people? Idol-worshipping family. Why was Abraham challenged in that way, and what is the lesson of calling the place the Lord will provide? I'm going to take away my thunder, and I'm going to tell you what that hill is. You know what that hill is at Moriah? That's eventually where David would be shown by revelation of the Lord that the temple ought to be built. That's where Solomon built it. That's also the hill off the side of it where Jesus died. And it became a, even in Abraham's day, it became a phrase, on the mountain of the Lord, it'll be provided.